Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Christopher Greenwood. I'm the convener of the Law Department here and Professor of International Law. And it's my pleasure this evening to welcome to the school Professor Bob Manukin, Samuel Williston Professor of Law at Harvard University, and a Harvard man born and bred. But at the moment, as a chair created by the Belgian Frankie Foundation at the University of Leiden. Now, it's not Leiden, it's Louvain, isn't it? I do beg your pardon. A terrible slip of the tongue there.
Louvain.
At the University of Leuven, or Louvain, depending on which part of Belgium you come from, but not the University of Leiden, which is in the Netherlands, and is a graphic illustration of how, when you reach my age in life, you really should wear your reading spectacles to try and read manuscript notes. I might have a little bit more luck with his publications, which are numerous. He is a specialist in negotiation and has written extensively on that subject. Two books in particular I draw your attention to, Beyond Winning, Negotiating to Create Value in Deals and Disputes, a prize-winning work published 5 years ago, which has inspired, I think, much of what you will hear this evening, and a book with the provocative title Dividing the Child, The Judgment of Solomon in Negotiation. Again, something which may be of particular relevance to the topic he'll speak on this evening. But my own particular favourite in his publications list is a book from 1999, Negotiating on Behalf of Others, Advice to Lawyers, Business Executives, Sports Agents, Diplomats, Politicians, and Everybody Else. And that certainly is something which provides ample scope for this evening. The topic on which he'll speak this evening is Untangling the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, a Negotiation Perspective. It would be impossible, I think, to find a more important topic, a more difficult topic, a more challenging topic, and certainly impossible to find a speaker better qualified to speak upon it. And I invite you to welcome him this evening.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Sharing with you some ideas on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I want to begin by suggesting the question that really got me very interested in this topic as a negotiation analyst about 3.5 or 4 years ago, and that is a paradox of sorts. The paradox is that if there's going to be a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we all know what that resolution is, essentially. The basic deal is well understood. And yet, this violent conflict persists. And as a negotiation analyst, what I wanted to think about is, why is this so? Let me say a few more words about the paradox. There's an obvious two-state deal that in all probability could make the vast majority of Israelis and Palestinians far better off than the current state of affairs. It would involve the creation of a new Palestinian state, living at peace with a secure Israel that remains a democratic Jewish state. Now, needless to say, as a lawyer, I know that the devil is often in the details, and there are a set of difficult, what's called in the region, final status issues. There, first of all, is the question of borders. What will be the border between the new Palestinian state and Israel? My own view is if there is going to be a deal, it's going to be a deal that will take as the starting point the Green Line, but that will involve, for compensation, both in terms of other land and other forms of compensation, some adjustments in order to incorporate within Israel some of the settlements that are very near the Green Line. Indeed, incorporating some of those settlements within Israel would mean that a majority of the Jews who were living in settlements might remain in Israel. But what it would also require, of course, is the dismantling of the vast majority of Israeli settlements. A second final status issue is Jerusalem, which, of course, is a very difficult and complicated topic. But nonetheless, the basic principle of what the deal is reasonably clear. Jerusalem would become a condominium of sorts. East Jerusalem, Jerusalem, it turns out, is a substantially segregated city. The Jewish sections would be part of Israel. The Palestinian sections, where Palestinians are living, would become part of the Palestinian state. And like a condominium, there would be some domains that would be shared. And, of course, there'd have to be provisions for the holy sites. A third element, there has to be provision for Israeli security. One consequence, and I think there are a number of unfortunate consequences, but one consequence of the Iraq War is, I think, that this is less complicated than it might have been in earlier years, because I think it's not going to really require very much by the way of Israel, the provisions for the Israeli army in any way in the Jordan Valley, but it will require the new Palestinian state not to necessarily be demilitarized, but to have constraints on what kind of army they might have. The two sticky issues, of course, are settlements. This deal would require the evacuation of a large number of Jewish settlements presently housing, where there are presently living tens of thousands of Jewish settlers. The deal would also require a definitive determination of what the Palestinians describe as an individual and collective right of return. For reasons I'm going to describe, I think this is a particularly difficult issue, the refugee issue. But the nub of it is, although I think my own belief would be there'd have to be some form of Israeli expression of regret and perhaps even apology, and there certainly would have to be some forms of compensation for Palestinian refugees, the deal would not permit individual Palestinians to choose to return to Haifa or Tel Aviv because their grandparents lived there. Now, I think that my thesis is a very simple one, and it's really my main message of tonight. And that is that in understanding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in understanding the paradox I described, the reason there has been no resolution, and the reason resolution is extremely difficult is because within each community, there are very profound internal conflicts that make it very difficult to manage domestically, putting together the consensus necessary to make the deal. Now, in fact, for those of you who are students of either negotiation or, for that matter, political science, my colleague at Harvard, Robert Putnam, has written extensively about two-level games, about how, in fact, in most international negotiations, you have domestic politicians negotiating with other domestic politicians, which means that at the same time they are negotiating across the table with their counterpart on the other side, they are also involved in very complicated internal negotiations behind the table, what Putnam calls a second-level game. Now, Bob Putnam actually got the idea for his two-level game notion from some earlier work done in labor management relations by colleagues of mine at Harvard in the program of negotiation. They were experts at labor law who said that in collective bargaining, there was not one negotiation, but there were at least three. There was a negotiation across the table between management and the union, but there was also a negotiation behind the table within the union. And there was also a negotiation behind the table, often within the organization or management as well. Well, my argument, I mean, really draws on those kinds of ideas. And what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is just help you understand a little better what these two profound internal conflicts are all about. I believe that within Israel, the internal conflict has been very substantially over the future of the Jewish settlements. Among Palestinians, the internal conflict has been, as we can see today, over whether there should be one state or two, and what the scope, I'm going to argue, is what the scope, it's always been a difficult topic. The scope and meaning of the right of return. And what I'd like to do is say a bit more about each of those internal conflicts. First, during most of the past 3 years, the focus of my energy, where I began, was really studying and trying to think about what the program of negotiation might do about the internal conflict within Israel over the future of the settlements. A little bit of background. There are presently in the West Bank not 200,000 settlers, as this graph shows, because this graph ends in the year 2000, but 250,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Now, what I want you to notice here, too, and in my view it's a very sad fact, is during the Oslo process, which was essentially 1993 to the year 2000, the number of West Bank settlers doubled, expanded enormously. There are now, as I say, 250,000 Jews living in 120 settlements in the West Bank. Although it's a little hard to see, each of these triangles represents a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. It looks like the West Bank has chickenpox. And there are, as you can see, a great number of them. Most of the settlements are rather small, a few hundred families or less. Some, however, are quite substantial. Many people think that the settlers are all of one sort. That is an error. The Jewish settlers in the West Bank, I think, can be best divided into three groups. Half of the 250,000 are what I call secular settlers. They settled in the West Bank because the housing was cheap, it was subsidized, and they, for the most part, commute to Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. They did not move to the West Bank out of any strong ideological desire. A quarter of the settlers are what Israelis call the Haredim. They are the ultra-Orthodox. The Haredim have always liked to live in rather closed communities. They are ultra-Orthodox in the sense that they, most of them, dress and look as if they're coming out of an Eastern European ghetto, around, not dressed not too dissimilarly to the way they might have been dressed in 1810 or 1820 in Poland. They are very religious. Historically, the Haredim have not participated very much in Israeli political life. They do not serve in the military. They have never been a very important political force or social force within Israel. And I like to say, sometimes only half in jest, the reason they went and they've settled in the West Bank is because the housing was cheap and it permitted them to live together as a community. And I sometimes claim, and this is a slight exaggeration, that for the Haredim, for a Haredim community, if their Rebbe told them, well, now it's time to go to Topeka, Kansas, and we'll go as a group, they'd go. It's not as if living in the West Bank, at least initially, had any very special meaning to them. The driving force behind the settlement movement, the settlement project, are what I call national religious settlers. They are religious Zionists. They are, by my eyes, what one would call, they're orthodox, they're observant, but they're not ultra-orthodox. They very much serve in the army. The national religious settlers took the somewhat surprising outcome of the 1967 war as a sign from God that the time had come for the Jews to occupy the biblical heartland again, something which, in fact, in their view, is a necessary precondition for the coming of the Messiah. And for these national religious settlers, the settlement project is a very potent fusion of both religious and nationalist ideology. They are fierce nationalists who believe that by settling the West Bank, they are fulfilling their God-commanded duty as part of a Zionist tradition. Well, let me say a little bit about the nature of the internal conflict over the settlements. If one wants to think about why relocating settlers is difficult, putting aside religious ideology, there are obvious reasons. First of all, who would ever want to be moved from their home? Secondly, there are security issues involved in leaving the West Bank for Israel. There are economic costs, which I'll say a little bit more about, for the society as a whole. But what has intrigued me the most is why these national religious settlers have been so effective in terms of driving a project which most Israelis didn't particularly approve of in terms of settling the West Bank. What explains what has historically, in my mind, been their very disproportionate political power? Why do I say disproportionate? Well, if I'm right that the national religious settlers are a fifth or a fourth of the 250,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, that means there are approximately 60,000 of them in the West Bank. They represent only slightly more than 1% of the Jewish population of Israel. They are a tiny minority. Why have they been so effective over the years in driving their project? I think there are a number of reasons, and I've listed a bunch of them here. They're very well organized. They're overrepresented in the Knesset. Within the settler organizations, the Yeshe Council in particular, it turns out that the national religious settlers, although only a quarter of all the settlers, effectively control it. They've developed a close relationship to the military because the military is in the West Bank, often protecting them. But what and they have often been willing to use hardball and even violent tactics within Israel. What I have found most interesting, though, is that, because I didn't think any of these explanations were quite sufficient, is that the settlers have been able to appeal to themes that have much broader resonance among Israelis generally. And I think to understand the impact, you have to understand this. First, they see themselves as pioneers, settling the land and creating facts on the ground. They say to Israelis, we're doing something not very different in kind to what your grandparents did. when they were in the first or second or third Aliyah, came to Israel, acquired land in a hostile territory, and created a new state. They have framed their project as the natural continuation of Zionism. Now, I assure you that probably even a majority of Israelis disagree with that, but of course, interestingly, many Palestinians would completely agree that the Zionist movement was that they, a movement of settling the land. Historically, during the modern period, the elite in Israel were often those who were brought up on the kibbutz. As most of you probably know, historically Israel was had a very communitarian socialist ethos. And the leaders, the ideological leaders in many ways, were those who lived on the kibbutz. Well, the kibbutz movement, I can report, in modern Israel is essentially defunct. Israel now is really a modern first world country with high tech and everything else. However, these settlers, the national religious settlers, have been able to frame themselves as being the successors to the kibbutz movement, as expressing a communitarian spirit in a capitalist age. In many societies, as you can well imagine, there's a nostalgia for what one imagines things used to be like. And in Israel, which is a contemporary, for the most part, very modern, secular, industrial place, there is still broadly a kind of nostalgia for this communitarian past, a nostalgia for the idea that we are a closely knit community, although in fact most live, Tel Aviv is a big metropolitan area. Well, in terms within Israel today, what communities really are tight communities in which people are very mutually supportive and are very close to one another? These settlements, where everybody does know their neighbors. Israel, there's always been a respect for what is called the serving elite, those who were prepared for the national interest to make substantial sacrifices. These national religious settlers are often portraying themselves as being a serving elite. And indeed, in the face of quite considerable danger, they are living in places where life is very hard. They're not doing it for the money, I assure you. And they frame their own activities in these terms. And finally, they draw on religious notions, the idea that they are resettling the ancient biblical lands. Now, the truth is that in biblical times, the Jews were not particularly along the coast where Tel Aviv is. Judea and Samaria were in the West Bank. And the Bible, although Israel today is predominantly a secular, not religious country, the Bible is taught as part of almost national history, not in a religious sense, but in the secular school, the Bible is still taught. And it is not as if even secular Israelis don't often have some notion of thinking, well, wouldn't it be nice if, in fact, we were able to resettle these ancient sites? Well, for all these reasons, settlers can create much broader appeal and, I think, can create ambivalence on the part of Israelis who, in fact, on balance, are not in favor of the settlements project. Let me now say a few words about the internal Palestinian conflict. Well, anyone who reads the newspapers, of course, understands the intense nature of the internal conflicts among Palestinians today. There, of course, is a very profound conflict over whether between Hamas and Fatah, and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, about whether Israel as a state should be recognized at all, and whether there should be a two-state solution at all, or whether instead the solution is to get rid of the Jews and have a single state. In February, I've been in the last 3 or 4 years, I've made a number of trips to the region to do some work I'll describe in a little more detail. But I visited this February several refugee camps, and one of them is Dahisha. Dahisha is a refugee camp outside of Bethlehem. And what I have a picture of here is Dahisha's silent protest to Oslo. And my guide pointed this out to me with pride, and I said, "Say more." And he said, "Well, what's the shape of that?" And I said, "Well, it looks like, I guess, the region." And he said, "Exactly. Our protest was, all of this is Palestine. And in fact, in Dahisha, we were angry about Oslo and the notion that there was going to be a two-state solution." Now, that doesn't mean that all refugees or all Palestinians believe that, but Dahisha's silent protest to Oslo is suggestive. Now, what I like to, in fact, suggest is that the conflict that isn't much discussed but is very real is the conflict among Palestinians over the scope and meaning of the right of return. Now, this is different than the conflict among Israelis over the settlements project and the national religious settlers' idea of an Eretz Israel that would encompass the West Bank. Palestinians rhetorically, overwhelmingly express commitment to the right of return as a legal and moral imperative, as an individual and collective right. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, the implications are pretty stunning. The best, although everything about this domain is contested in some ways, essentially 750,000 Palestinians left Israel, fled Israel, during what Israel called its War of Independence, what the Palestinians call the disaster. And they and their descendants presently live, as you can see from this, in the West Bank and Gaza, but also in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and the Palestinian diaspora is much broader. There are Palestinians living in North America and in Europe as well. The refugees and their descendants today number around 4 million people. And although Israelis agree on very little, the one thing there is a complete consensus about is that there can be no resolution if a significant number of Palestinian refugees and their descendants return to Israel. Indeed, in the words of Sari Nusseibeh, a very courageous Palestinian intellectual, if literally there were a right to return, there would not be one Palestinian state, there'd be two Palestinian states, because Israel would become a Palestinian state in terms of the demography. And although Israeli Jews can agree on very little, the one thing they can agree on is that they overwhelmingly, well over 90%, want Israel to remain a democratic Jewish state. Today, 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinians. But if there were a significant number of Palestinian refugees returning, the demography would in fact shift quite radically. Now, in fact, as you can imagine, and I can't elaborate in great detail tonight because there really isn't time, but among Palestinians, there are very different views about the importance of this right of return. Although symbolically it's important, Palestinian cosmopolitans all say, we understand that with a two-state solution, There can be no broad right of return. On the other hand, many Palestinian refugees and their descendants for 40 years have dreamt of little else. You visit Palestinians, and the key, you know, the rhetorical keys to the old house are still there. As you can imagine, however, given the differences among Palestinians and Palestinian refugees, differences in generation, in geography, in class, and in clans, there are very, very different attitudes towards this right of return. In fact, a Palestinian pollster named Shakaki did a poll of Palestinian refugees and their descendants and found that really only a minority would want to return to Israel. Nevertheless, it has enormous symbolic import. And the thing that I have found that is deeply troubling is among Palestinians, in terms of political discourse, there has been very little candid discussion about, as a practical matter, what is going to be done for refugees. How is the refugee problem going to be handled? Now, I think there are a number of very interesting parallels in terms of these internal conflicts, and I'd like to just point some of them out. First, both Israeli Jews and Palestinians have narratives, historical narratives, based on suffering and victimization. Israel, after all, came about in part as a result of the horror of the Holocaust in World War II. The Palestinian movement has been premised on the idea of victimization. Both involve deep issues of identity. The Palestinian movement has framed itself as a refugee movement in many ways. For national religious settlers particularly, their identity is that we are carrying out a God-required mandate to settle Eretz Israel. Both refugees and the settlers, in fact, rhetorically, are able to make claims that have broader resonance within their society. Moderates on both sides, Israeli moderates, have long known, many of course have vehemently opposed the expansion of the settlements, and many of them have long known that in fact if there's going to be a two-state solution, tens of thousands of settlers would have to be relocated. Similarly, Palestinians know, many acknowledge in private conversation, that of course refugees won't be able to return to Israel proper if there's going to be a two-state resolution. But moderates on both sides, when I say have had a bargaining chip mentality, Palestinians have said to me, well, why should we say anything to suggest that we're not going to demand a right of return until at least there are final status negotiations, because it's a bargaining chip. Similarly, the labor government, which was complicit over the years in many ways in terms of the expansion of the settlement movement, although they really weren't in favor of it, thought, well, maybe this will put some additional pressure on the Arab countries and the Palestinians to negotiate a land for peace deal, because they'll see that, in fact, it's going to get harder and harder to make such a deal the longer they wait. It's a good bargaining chip. And the terrible dilemma in my mind, of course, is in both cases this, quote, bargaining chip really was toying with the lives of tens of thousands of people who really believed in the dream, either the dream of Eretz Israel or the dream of return. Both the refugee problem and the dismantling of settlements is going to require relocation and compensation on a very broad scale. there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who would need to be relocated, some of whom are today living in perfectly appalling conditions, especially in Lebanon. And the economic consequences in terms of compensation, very, very substantial. And the last point, which I think is a critical one, is it's not just about money. For there to be a resolution in terms of a two-state solution, tens of thousands of people are going to really be asked to give up a dream that has been part of what has kept them going over the years. Now, all of this is simply to raise for you the obvious, and that is that the internal tensions created by either relocating tens of thousands of settlers or bringing the news to refugees that although there may be a right to return to the new Palestinian state and there may be compensation, there won't be any return to Israel, poses profound leadership problems. And that, of course, is part of my main message. Well, what could be done? One thing that I have, during the last 3 years, been doing, I've now just begun really working earnestly in terms of the internal conflict among Palestinians, but I've done a fair amount of work in terms of the internal conflict among Israeli Jews. And part of what I thought would be interesting was to create, I thought there was a real need within Israel for an internal dialogue off the record among Israeli leaders about the internal conflict. And to that end, because I think there really is an urgent need for dialogue within each community, moderate Israelis and moderate Palestinians, I cannot tell you how many times there have been third-track meetings of all sorts. My own view is moderate Israelis and moderate Palestinians, although it would be difficult, could have made a deal several years ago. We all know basically what the deal is, the Geneva Accord, the Ayalon-Nusseibeh Initiative. The deal, the essentials of the deal are pretty well known. In my mind, that's not the problem. The problem's internal, and there hasn't been nearly some enough internal dialogue. To that end, the program on negotiation, I sponsored five off-the-record dialogue sessions with Israeli Jews over the internal conflict. I'm not going to describe to you in any detail who all these people are. The first set, these are pictures that were taken at this dialogue session. The first five are leaders of the National Religious Settler Movement. They include the head of the Benjamin Regional Council. They include two very important journalists. They include someone who's now a member of Parliament. It also included some quite important figures who are not settlers within Israel. Major General Amador was the head of the Army's Research and Assessment Division. He was the first religious Jew ever to reach the rank of general within Israel. Amon Lipkin Shahak was the former Israeli Defense Corps Chief of Staff. He was twice awarded Medals of Valor. A very now retired military guy who is literally at the very top of the Israeli military establishment. Gilead Scher has become a very close friend, a 50-year-old attorney. He was chief of staff for Prime Minister Barak. He was the chief Israeli negotiator during the Camp David talks. Janet Aviad was a founder of Peace Now, a very progressive Israeli group, which for more than 20 years has been leading the fight against the expansion of settlements and monitoring that process. Admiral Ami Ayalon is a retired admiral who headed the Israeli Navy. He was the principal author of the Ayalon-Nusseibeh Peace Initiative. Moshe Habertal is a very distinguished academic, professor at Hebrew University, an observant Jew who's a deeply committed liberal. So what was interesting about this process is I had people who were strongly committed to very different points of view. What did I learn from this dialogue? Well, the first thing, it confirmed in me, for me, something Amos Oz wrote, an Israeli author, over 20 years ago. And that is that the conflicts over the future of the occupied territories were really conflicts over deep, deep issues about the character of the state of Israel, the meaning of Jewish heritage, the relationship of Jewish values and Western culture. This conflict involves profound issues of identity. One of the settlers said during one of our dialogue sessions, and it was very moving, he said, "Of course I could move back. But if I'd be moving back to a secular, hedonistic, materialistic Tel Aviv, that, for me, is not what Israel is about." Another of the participants in the dialogue said to the settlers, "Your project, your demand for land, is going to destroy this country and represents a repudiation of all the Jewish values I hold most dear. I will never leave Israel, but if you persist in this, my children and grandchildren will not live in this country." Now, I report those kinds of things just to sort of say how deep the conflict is and how, in fact, emotionally charged it is. On both sides, people have been profoundly wounded. Israeli politics, internal politics, are quite brutal. War heroes have been spit upon by settlers. Settlers who were shocked by the Rabin assassination some years ago were personally accused of having been complicit. One of the participants said, it's a little bit, after the Rabin assassination, the accusations that somehow I wanted this, she said, it's a little bit as if one's husband accused you of adultery when you knew, in fact, there had been none. After the accusation is made, you never can feel quite the same, just because you realize they could think that of you. Now, so one thing I learned is that it's an identity conflict. The protagonists have deeply wounded each other. That in terms of internal politics, a lot of it has been what we negotiation analysts call a game of chicken, where the settlers say, you relocate us and this country is going to be torn apart. And the non-settlers say, we're going to move you. And it's got to happen. What was also very interesting is that there was a willingness to explore common values and interests. Can dialogue make a difference? I think it can. And indeed, one of the things that was very moving to me is that after our second dialogue session, Amie Alon, this Israeli admiral, considered within Israel as someone certainly center-left, who with Sari Nusseibeh created one of the great peace initiatives. There was the first peace rally in Tel Aviv. This was after Prime Minister Sharon announced his intention to evacuate Gaza. And I alone gave a talk, because he was the first speaker at this peace rally. And what he said was, to those present, who, they, by the way, as he said very unwisely, when did they plan the peace rally? Saturday afternoon about 4 o'clock, thus ensuring that no observant Jews would be there. He said, we never really created a dialogue. Perhaps we never wanted to. We turned the settlers of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza into our enemies. We arrogantly turned them out. We monopolized the quest for peace. That is why the majority, what he was saying to the peace rally, that's why the majority did not come here today, although I know that today of all days they wanted to come. The majority wants to leave as much as we do. but they want to do so after lowering the national flag to half-mast, observing a minute's silence, and wiping a tear at the shattering of their Zionist dream. The majority will feel connected to us only when the pain of those slated to be evacuated drowns. And what I found very moving, and I said this to Iallone afterwards, I wrote him, I said, you know, sometimes, as a professor, I have a confession to make. Sometimes you read an exam and you think, my God, in the time permitted, could I have written something so good? And if you're honest with yourself, you simply give that exam an A+ and move on quickly, and you don't want to think about it too much. But Iallone, I think, really expressed beautifully what I think is terribly important in terms of the internal conflicts on both sides, and that is the need to combine empathy with assertiveness. Empathy because within each community, there are those who are going to be called upon to sacrifice very substantially. Assertiveness because we should be under no illusions that they will want to do it voluntarily. And the political challenge is in many ways managing that process. Well, what's the situation today? I want to simply conclude with a few observations. Within Israel, I think the evacuation from Gaza has had a profound internal effect. Within Israel, I think there is a consensus, very nearly, that in fact, most of the settlements are going to have to go, and that Israel should do it unilaterally. Olmert ran on this ground, even if it isn't part of a negotiation. I think within Israel, there is skepticism about, even if there is a Palestinian state, whether that Palestinian state will be able to control internal violence directed towards Israel. But I think there is a very strong urge to try to create boundaries, to separate. That's what the fence is all about, and I certainly don't want to be heard as saying that I think the fence is in the right place, but I think that's what Olmert's campaign was all about, too. The need to set boundaries. I think that among Palestinians, the election obviously demonstrated a profound feeling that Fatah, they were tired of Fatah's corruption. They were tired of Fatah's being ineffectual. There is within what the West Bank and Gaza today a very profound internal conflict, which is at times, as we've seen in the accounts, violent. Hamas, notwithstanding substantial pressure, internal and externally, external pressure from other Arab countries, external pressure from the quartets, has not acknowledged that Israel has a right to exist, has not indicated a willingness to abide by any of the earlier agreements. Between Abu Mazen and the new Hamas-dominated government, there's very deep conflict. I think, in fact, the implications of my analysis are pretty clear. I do not think the time is in any sense ripe for final status negotiations across the table. I think there are critical tasks to be done within each community, within Israel. The need for planning of how, in fact, will literally tens of thousands of settlers be evacuated, housed, reabsorbed into Israeli society. It's a very big set of issues. I was informally, my project did some thinking about what kind of compensation mechanisms there should be, how this could be managed. I think the good news of the Gaza evacuation, and it's very good news indeed, is that Israeli democracy held. They were able to evacuate Gaza without bloodshed, and many within Israel, I think, feared the worst. Within the Palestinian community, I think the time is long past where there ought to be plans made. What can be done for the refugees? It's not an easy task, but in fact, the Palestinian leadership, in my view, has too often used the refugee issue simply as a rhetorical toy without paying any serious attention to it. Finally, I think the international community can play a useful but rather limited role. I think too often in Europe the view is that since we all know what the deal might be, Europeans too often think, well, the reason we don't have the deal, it's the United States' fault, because if the United States would just get tough with Israel, the settlers would be evacuated and resettled. And why won't the United States do it? Well, the conventional wisdom, once again, it's because the Jewish lobby is so powerful. All right? Now, in fact, my own view is that George Bush is at least as influenced by the attitudes of Christian fundamentalists as the Jewish lobby. But much more fundamentally, I think if Iraq has taught us anything, it's to have a certain modesty about our capacity to intervene internally in other societies to manage internal conflicts. I think it's a very delicate, hard thing to do, and I don't for a minute believe that the quartet or anyone else can resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict if Israelis and Palestinians don't want to do it. And I think that in terms of Israelis and Palestinians wanting to do it, there is enormous need for internal work within both communities. And that's not to say that the international community can't do things that are helpful, but I think there is a profound arrogance on the part of many in the international community that think that, well, with this intractable conflict, if we just sort of pull the right strings and apply the right pressures, somehow these very deep, historically embedded internal conflicts are going to be resolved. Who can make peace? My bet, if I have to make a prediction, Marwan Barghouti is the guy. He's presently in an Israeli jail, I think serving 4 life sentences because of his complicity in some violence, in fact, in terms of death. Barghouti is the man who, by the way, Abu Mazen just... Barghouti proposal that was put together earlier in May that Abu Mazen now is insisting that Hamas either accept or put to a referendum in terms of whether Palestinians will accept a two-state solution, using the Green Line as the basis for a resolution. Regrettably, from my point of view, the rhetoric in terms of what Barghouti wrote with respect to the refugee issue is the same old rhetoric. I mean, there's no attempt to really deal with it at a very deep level. But when I was in at the University of Bethlehem in February and I interviewed about a dozen student leaders, I asked them who their hero was. This is the guy. And Abu Mazen, in my mind, can't make peace. I have no notion of whether Barghouti necessarily would want to make peace. But my own view is it was no accident that Sharon was the one who was able to evacuate Gaza. This is a domain where Nixon, the old adage about Nixon going to China, that you need a conservative doing certain things, applies. And I think the Israeli claim that, well, we don't have the right kind of partner, where their implicit notion is the right kind of partner is a Palestinian moderate, is nonsense, because a Palestinian moderate can't make the compromises and sell them internally that would be necessary. So I think that as was true in South Africa, as was true in Northern Ireland, most of all what you have to hope for is at some point there will be leadership who really, and leaders who will have the capacity to lead in this terribly difficult context. Let me conclude by sharing with you something that made very poignant for me this conflict and what a terrible conflict it is. You cannot meet an Israeli who doesn't know someone personally who's died because of Palestinian terror. You cannot meet a Palestinian who typically doesn't have a relative who was in Israeli jail and who hasn't suffered terribly. The degree of suffering because of this conflict is very profound. On February 24th, a former program on negotiation fellow named Amal Jaddou, she's the young woman right here, she presently works for Abu Mazen in Ramallah, and I met with her in Ramallah, and she asked me to come have lunch on Friday with her family. And this is her family. Her mother, who's veiled, is a math teacher, middle school math teacher. Her father is a retired civil servant. They live in the Aida refugee camp right outside of Bethlehem. Her brother is seated on the arm of this chair. He's a journalist. Her brother's new bride is seated next to him. Where did he meet his bride? He met his bride when he was covering the Israeli demolition of his bride's family's house. Warm, marvelous family. I had lunch there. I had already arranged later that day. I'd been invited by Rabbi Abi Gieser, who's the rabbi in Ofra, which is a flagship settlement. Rabbi Gieser is on the right. I'm over here. To spend Shabbat with his family. I said to my Palestinian driver, I said, Friday's going to be quite an extraordinary day, and I fear I don't want you talking about either where I'm going or where I've come from, because I'm going to be going from a refugee camp where I'm having lunch to I'm spending the night in Rabbi Gieser's house, and then the next day you're going to pick me up. This is Rabbi Gieser's family with his children and grandchildren. What was so striking to me, both these families, in my view, I'm genuinely fond of both. Gieser is an extraordinary man. He's the spiritual leader in Ofra. Growing up, I did not know any people like Rabbi Gieser, but the notion that he has horns, that he's is just wrong, even though he's the spiritual leader of these national religious settlers. Rabbi Gieser, by the way, I spent over a year putting together this dialogue group. He was part of it. Rabbi Gieser said to me, Professor Mnuchin, what you're working on, what you're trying to do is profoundly important, and I want to be helpful in any way I can. I shouldn't tell this story, but I'll tell it. I assume there aren't any reporters here. And Rabbi Gieser says, but I'll participate only on one condition. And I said, what's that condition? And he said, everybody who comes to our dialogue session has to acknowledge in advance, this is our land. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be a challenge. Janet Aviat, a founder of Peace Now, you know, but I had the wit in Mediation 101, often what you want to do is listen and ask another question. So I said to him, you obviously feel very strongly about this, say more. And he said, yes, he said, if there's an acknowledgement that this is our land, maybe this is not the time that God thinks we should be possessing the land. And I want to make too much of that, but I mean, as a mediator, what I knew, of course, is there's a glimmer there. And in fact, I think he's played a very constructive role, and I hope he continues to play a constructive role in the months to come. What I think was most striking, though, about both these families is Amal Jaddou put it to me very well. She said, I was raised being taught of the fundamental importance of three things. And I said to her, what are those three things? And she said, faith, family, and education. And what was stunning to me is in visiting and spending time with these two families on the 24th is exactly the same thing could be said of both these families. And what I do hope is that this terrible conflict will, in fact, be dampened and ultimately resolved in a constructive way with a two-state solution. Thank you very much.
We've got time for a few questions, but I fear only a few. There are three basic ground rules, please. First, would you begin by saying who you are? Please do this even if you think you are tremendously well known and famous, because first of all, you may not be recognizable from behind, and secondly, you may not be quite as famous as you think you are. This way, all honor and dignity are preserved. Secondly, would you ask a question, please, rather than making a speech or a statement? And it's not a question to make a speech and then tag, "So what do you think?" on at the end of it. And thirdly, would you keep your question single and brief? Now, who's first, please? I'll take three and then ask Professor Manukin to answer them. If I could invite the people with the microphones, please. Here, first of all, then in the back row, and then over here in the far corner. Thank you. Somebody else could take the microphone upstairs in case there's anyone upstairs who has a question.
My name is Jim Kennedy. As an octogenarian, I'm no longer affiliated. The first point doesn't count as a question. I just wondered whether your presentation is going to be published on the website somewhere, LSE or otherwise. Now the question. I wonder what sort of resonance you believe that your proposal might find in the next USA administration, and possibly also in each of the constituencies of the respective communities.
And now at the back. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, it's working. I'm a PhD student at Destin. I'm writing on the Kosovo-Serbian-Albanian conflict, and I found there were many parallels. My question is a very brief one, actually. Going back to what you said were the internal conflicts in the Palestinian side and in the Israeli side, and the speech that you mentioned that the general was giving on the peace rally, what did you find helped to overcome those emotionally charged or difficult or identity issues? You raised a few terms, leadership. They were, I would call, maybe taboos to issue. What did you find helped you or helped those people to tackle those issues within their communities?
Thank you. And the third question was over here. Thank you.
I'm Gabriel Newfield. My question is about the two states, by which I take it you mean not two equally prosperous states, but certainly two viable states. Can you say a little bit about what that implies? I'm thinking of obvious things like an equitable distribution of water, port facilities, and so on. That's a sort of suppressed major premise, it seems to me, in your analysis.
Great.
Right. Would you like to answer this?
Let me first... yes, my overheads, but without the pictures of the individuals, will be on the LSE website tomorrow. And I have written a couple things, and we'll probably arrange somehow for the sites to be there, too, for those who are interested. You asked about what resonance my proposal has. Well, my proposal, I mean, the two-state solution that I envision, is really no different. It's very similar to what President Clinton suggested in his letter to the parties as to the principles that should inform the resolution when the Camp David negotiations failed. I think it's quite consistent, although the details vary, with the Geneva Initiative and, as I said, the Ayalon-Nisseba Initiative. In fact, it's not so far from where the parties themselves were headed in the Taba negotiations, which occurred, of course, much too late in January of 2001. So in terms of resonance, my own view is that within moderates on both sides, there would be very great resonance. And I think that with the quartet, there would be resonance. I think that the challenge is, on both sides, there are what in negotiation terms we call potential spoilers. And how do you deal with that? how do you build a winning coalition on both sides? How do you dampen the internal violence on both sides and within both sides? I think that's the real challenge. I think there are interesting parallels, and the Kosovo conflict, of course, is a very profound one, that very, very difficult, interesting conflict. You asked, really, how do you tackle these issues within each community? And I think I don't have any easy answers as to how to do that. I guess I think it has to be done in lots of different ways. I think taboos that make things undiscussable, and where in terms of internal politics, people demonize internal opponents, is not helpful. And I guess what I have found helpful is something that some concepts that I've used in a lot of my negotiation analysis, and that is the need for both empathy and assertiveness. And I think it's quite challenging. I think on a micro level, often having a facilitated conversation where an outsider is not trying to tell people what to do, but is helping them have the conversation, is sometimes helpful. The last question really had to do with the viability of the two states. And I think that's a very deep and important issue. Water, in my mind, is not going to be a killer issue. A friend and colleague, Frank Fisher, who's an economist at MIT, with some economists from various Arab countries and within Israel, worked out a very elaborate, very interesting, almost market-based scheme where the water issues, although of huge symbolic import, could be managed. And I think they could be managed. I think the terrible dilemma is the following. Will a new Palestinian state be a viable state, or will it be a failed state? Can it be economically viable? And the terrible dilemma, I think the deepest problem, and I think you've put your finger on it implicitly at least, is the following. It's one about which I at times despair. The Israeli desire for separation, in my mind, is entirely understandable. No society, if subjected to terror, will stand by and not try to protect itself by creating some kind of border. And I'm not saying the border is in the right place. My own personal view is it's probably in the wrong place. But the Israeli desire to create a border is really understandable. The terrible dilemma is that without the engine of the Israeli economy as a motor, can there be a successful Palestinian economy? And it's a real question in my mind. And I think to that extent, I mean, it's really an issue, you know, between the United States and Mexico, we have a very porous border. And indeed, right now, as we speak, there are great congressional negotiations going on over it. Having a porous border economically would be extremely valuable to the Palestinians. But for that to come about, the terror has to be controlled. And that's the dilemma. And it's a terrible dilemma. And I think this is not to say there couldn't be a successful Palestinian state with a very strict border. But what the Israelis have discovered is they can manage their own economy very well without Palestinian labor. There are guest workers from Asia, from other parts of the world. They're managing. But whether the Palestinians can manage very easily without Palestinian workers being able to work in Israel proper, it's a harder question. So I think you've posed a very deep and important issue, and one that I worry about.
Now, I think we've got time for two more questions. There was a lady at the back there. Anybody upstairs? And the gentleman at the far back on the right-hand side upstairs. I think the two of you intervened before anybody else had a chance to. So this lady here first.
It's with regard to the right to return. Presuming that some kind of compensation-based solution was accepted, who would have the prerogative to accept it? Because that would require the acceptance of the refugees themselves, but also of the guest states, which I don't see that happening. I mean, with regard to Lebanon, for one, that would create a huge problem for the Lebanese state.
For the what state?
For the Lebanese state, with regards to Lebanon.
OK. thank you. I'm going to cut you off there, I'm afraid, and invite the
second
question.
So who would accept? I mean, who would be yes, have the authority?
I think you've made your point. I just want to give the other questioner a chance.
Hello there. Thank you for this comprehensive analysis of the problem. My name is Mohammed, a former student here. What I wanted to ask is two questions. How far can the Americans go in providing a what I call a feasible intervention with a problem? And also, how far can the quartet go in talking to the Israelis about a peaceful negotiation? Because the pressure lies in the West to talk to the Israelis and to bring about a peaceful resolution. There is a pressure within both sides, but at the end of the day, the answer comes back to the Americans and the Europeans.
Thank you very much.
Those are both, I think, excellent questions. Who can accept very deep, difficult problem? The Palestinian Liberation Organization claims to speak for the Palestinian diaspora, as well as those within the West Bank and Gaza, and those who might return to the West Bank and Gaza. And what kind of procedural mechanism there would be if there were to be a deal to have it ratified with respect to the refugee provisions within the refugee community? It's a terrific question. I don't know. Who gets to vote? Whose vote counts? And of course, there's even a something of a. It's not as if among Palestinians their interests are all the same. There are Palestinians within the West Bank who are not eager to have hundreds of thousands of other Palestinians move in. Within the Palestinian community, there are lots. It's not as if those in the West Bank necessarily are very fond of many of those in Gaza. There are a lot of divisions. And what procedural mechanisms there are, I think it's a question well worthy of study. How could it be ratified? How could it be accepted? The other question was, how far can the United States go? How far can the quartet go? I think what the United States and the quartet should do is think about what incentives can be created that might be helpful in terms of these internal problems leading towards a two-state solution. I guess most of all, though, I think that what concerns me most is the illusion that somehow, if the West plays it right, this problem can be solved easily, and that it's going to turn on what we do. I don't believe that. I think that we can do things that can be helpful. We can also do things that might be hurtful. Diplomats always are wanting to do things, but I guess. I guess part of my talk is a certain plea for modesty, particularly when you understand the internal nature of these conflicts.
Thank you. I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut the meeting short at that point. I'd like to thank Bob Manukian very much for a thought-provoking presentation. It certainly has made me focus more than I've ever done before on the fact that the solution between Israel and the Palestinians may well lie in sorting out the conflicts within Israel and within the Palestinian community. Bob, thank you very much indeed. We're all very much in your debt.